The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening and welcome back to our fifth class. And should we start again with some questions? Just so kind of a nice transition as people are still coming in. Anybody would like to ask about, meditation or the practice?
My question is, I do this mindfulness, Jon Kabat-Zinn mindfulness. It doesn't seem to me there's any kind of conflict. Would you feel there would be conflict with doing this meditation and also doing that meditation?
Absolutely not. They're very, very closely connected, not just historically they're connected. Jon Kabat-Zinn really, he was a Vipassana student. He got it from this tradition here. And then he adopted it for the clinical settings. And he tried to do it in such a way that the Buddhism part was hidden from view because it was not needed. But it's very similar.
Hi. If we miss some of the exercises prescribed in previous weeks, do you recommend we still do it in a sequential way as it's laid out? And I guess what would be a good time to move from one set of exercises to the next?
Well, when I was introduced to this practice in Burma, I was given a cassette tape that was 15 minutes long. And those 15 minutes, I was given the instructions, the entire instructions. So I'm kind of doing in 6 weeks what I was given in 15 minutes. What I'm trying to say here is that the core practice is relatively simple, and it's to pay attention to everything. But because that's kind of hard to figure out how to pay attention to everything, we've designed this to kind of build over these weeks. But there's no inherent necessity to do it in a sequential way. It's just we've learned that it seems to be a good way to introduce people, get them used to a certain area, and then move on. If you need to go back and review or going to do it again, I think the sequence makes a lot of sense. There's a logic to it. It builds from week to week. So you could do that, and how quickly you want to move between them is up to you. Some of you will find that this class is going way too fast. And some of you might like to just spend the next 6 months just on the first class, the mindfulness of breathing, and then another 6 months on the mindfulness of the body and really kind of get into it deeply. And some people feel like the class is not going fast enough because, I'm already thinking and what's this about the breath? I'm struggling with my thoughts and let's get on to the full instruction. And some people find it's better to have the full range of instructions right away and work with it all. Some people find it's better to go slowly. So how fast you go through it is up to you. And when you feel like you're ready to go on, when you feel like you have 1 week well enough understood, you can move on.
There's a similar question to the Jon Kabat-Zinn one. There's also an author, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Would you say that's pretty complimentary as well? Well,
certainly complimentary. Thich Nhat Hanh has one of the best-selling books in English on Buddhism. It's called The Miracle of Mindfulness. And Vietnamese Buddhism was very interesting because it was one of the few countries where there was a real hybridization of two major Buddhist traditions. And so he's a Zen teacher. But he also, because of this this lineage that we teach in here at IMC, also came into Vietnam in a big, strong way. He also picked up that very strongly. And so you find Thich Nhat Hanh kind of going back and forth sometimes between being more a mindfulness teacher and being more of a Zen teacher, and depending on the books you read or what's going on. But he has a very strong foundation in this tradition here, the early Buddhist tradition with the mindfulness. And so it's very complementary. So this is the week where I'm going to give instructions on what we called mindfulness of mind. But the word for mind in the Buddhist language, and the word citta, also can mean heart. So mindfulness of heart. And I like it because this word heart right now, because heart, the heart of the matter, the heart is more like the essence. And so we're coming down to something which is very core, very essential to the human being. So the Buddhists don't have a soul. We don't believe in souls, but we believe in the heart. And so now we're going to start noticing something that's very, if you can get a hang of what I'm trying to say here today, that's very core to who you are, the foundation for much else that arises from you. In a sense, we've kind of worked our way in with the breath and the body and feelings and thoughts, and now we come into this much more central place. And as I introduce it today, I'd like to tell a story, an ancient Buddhist story, of a man who was going to set out to go traveling from his home village. And before he left, a neighbor, a friend, came over when he was napping, sleeping, and sewed a jewel, very expensive jewel, in the lining of his coat, but didn't tell him. And then the man went off to travel the dusty world and spent many years, many, many years traveling, and ended up becoming somewhat destitute and poor and begging. And eventually, somehow or other, made it back after many years back to his home village, and he saw his old friend. And his old friend hardly recognized him because he was so down and out and destitute. But they reestablished connection, and his friend said, oh, you know, so the guy said, I've been poor. And then his friend said, no, not really. All along, look in your coat, look in the lining of your coat. And there was this jewel. All along, he had this jewel right there, close at hand. So it's kind of a silly story, but it's meant to be a metaphor. The idea that we can go traveling and searching all over for happiness, for peace, for well-being, for the truth or something, not knowing that how close at hand it is. It's always with us. It travels with us. It's as close as the lining of your coat, maybe even closer. And so this thing about the heart or the mind is pointing to some that in Buddhism is considered as a jewel, a treasure that we all carry with us. And so it's learning to kind of find that jewel or purify that jewel, connect to that. It's something that's always here, but it's often we don't pay attention to it because we're paying attention to so many other things. We don't notice what's so close at hand. So as a way of introducing it today, I would like to now start with a meditation session. And part of what I'll do in this meditation session is kind of review what we've talked about so far and then build from there. So if you can put yourself in a comfortable, alert posture. And then gently close your eyes. And as you do meditation practice, you should consider your body as your friend, as your supporter for this process. And so you want to find some way to ground yourself in your body. And one way to begin, that especially they do this in Zen, is as you're sitting here, sway left and right. Take first kind of a large arc, and then slowly make smaller and smaller arcs, feeling the sitting bones against your chair or cushion, until you find yourself kind of back into center. Kind of rock yourself into center. And then you could also do the same forward and backwards a little bit. Again, as a way of getting into your body, rocking yourself, slowing the rocks until you find yourself here. And then perhaps feeling the contact of your sitting bones, your butt against your cushion, your chair. And feel the contact, feel kind of grounded or connected. Feel the weight of your body as it's received by your cushion or your chair. Do all this as a reminder that you're going to be here. You're going to keep your attention in this place at this time, here in this body. And then as a way of also beginning, it's nice to take a few long, slow, deep breaths, expanding the rib cage, torso as you breathe in. Letting the front rib cage, the back rib cage expand. And then as you exhale, this longer exhale than usual perhaps, as you exhale, relax. Settle into your body. Taking a deep breath and settling in. And then letting your breathing return to normal. In this particular meditation practice, we make no special effort to breathe in any special way. So just whatever way you happen to be breathing is fine. Also, at the beginning of a sitting, it can be useful to scan through your body to see if there's any places of holding or tension that might be easy to relax or soften. Soften the muscles around your eyes and your forehead. It might be possible to soften the jaws. The shoulders, shoulder blades. Perhaps you can soften the belly. And all these preliminary steps are ways of settling in, being connected here to this body, reminding yourself to be present. And then within the body, as part of the bodily experience, notice how your body experiences breathing. So you're not so much watching your breathing as you are feeling it from the inside. And by beginning meditation with the breathing, we're trying to use the breathing as a way of gathering the mind together so that your attention is here instead of scattered, involved in a lot of thoughts and ideas. And coming back to the breath whenever you need to, letting go of your thoughts, gathering yourself around your breathing. letting go of your thoughts, coming back to your breathing. When you notice you've wandered off in thought, there's no need to judge that or be upset about it. Just very simply, easily, reconnect to your breathing and then try to hang in there so you can be aware of a number of breaths in a row. So there is an element of choice here, where we're choosing where the attention goes, what the attention notices. And just for now, we're choosing the best you can to let the attention take in the experience of breathing. And then if there's something happening, some strong sensation in your body, you can choose to let go of the breathing. Instead, take your awareness and bring it to that strong sensation in your body. And then take in that experience, that physical sensations, making an effort, gentle effort, to be calm about the experience, to be non-reactive. Or if there are strong sounds that are compelling, let go of the breathing and let yourself do listening meditation. And if there are emotions or feelings that are asking for attention, that are making it difficult for you to stay with your breathing, then contentedly let go of your breathing and let your awareness, your mindfulness, take in the emotion that's going on, the feeling. Naming it, allowing it to be there. And perhaps feeling how it manifests in your body, how you feel it, that emotion physically. The idea is to be very simple with it, calm, non-reactive, just noticing how you're feeling. And if thinking predominates, doesn't let go of easily, then you can turn your attention to be aware of the activity of thinking, the event of thinking. Quietly noting, thinking, perhaps feeling any physical manifestations of the thinking or any emotional connections to it, being content just to observe, just to be with it, no need to make anything go away, but just to really clearly acknowledge and see what is. And then if you're not there, come back to your breathing. Feel a few breaths. And in the range of the things you can experience directly here and now, these areas we've covered covers most of it. We have your breath, your bodily experiences, your emotional experiences, your cognitive experiences, sounds around you. Covers most things. And the idea is to be very as relaxed as possible, but also alert, and simply notice clearly what predominates. What's the experience you have in these different areas as they occur? Sometimes you can stay with your breathing nicely. Other times attention gets placed in the body. Other times you bring meditative attention to emotions. Other times you're thinking. Depending on what's happening, at different times you bring attention to different things. And if you're not sure or things are pretty quiet, just stay with your breathing. In a sense, the mindfulness is like a flashlight, a light that shines out from a flashlight and brings the light on whatever it's pointed at. It sees it more clearly, acknowledges it. And as you use a flashlight, You can notice what the light shines on. But you can also notice the quality of the light itself. Is it a wide beam of light? Is it a narrow beam? Is it a weak light or a strong light? Is it flickering or is it constant? In the same way, it's also possible to be mindful of the quality of the attention that you're using to pay attention to things. What is the quality of that attention? Is your awareness clear or dull? When you notice something, pay attention to something, do you pounce on it? Or are you laid back and easygoing about? Do you try hard or hardly try at all? Are you straining to notice? As you notice your breathing and the sounds in your body, can you notice anything about the quality, the characteristic of that which knows? And then behind the knowing, behind that effort to pay attention, how are you? Are you impatient, curious, relaxed about what is? How are you as someone who is trying to be mindful? How do you feel? And then the last couple of minutes of this sitting, come back to your breathing. And see if you're going to stay there with your breathing in a relaxed way. Settling more into your breathing. Being simple, just breathing. And then you can take a couple of deep breaths, feeling your body. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So the practice of mindfulness is the practice of noticing what is happening, what is, in the present moment. And it's a quite a, for many people, it's a very radical thing to do, because often the mind is not so attentive to what's actually happening in the present moment. It's not usually able to stay attentive to what's happening in the present moment very well, in a clear, direct way. Even if it is in the present moment, there's a lot of judgments, interpretations, stories, ideas, reactions to it. And if we're not in the present moment, then we're lost in thought and feelings and everything. And to train oneself to be present directly for what is means that we've learned to put to rest the reactive mind, the mind that gets pulled away or gets scattered, caught up, and the mind that so much doesn't want to accept how things are or want things to be different or wants to build up ourselves or defend ourselves or make a better future or make a better past. Many things we try to do. And to the degree to which that kind of predominates in a person's way of living, to simply be present for things they are as they are directly in a very simple way is a radical thing to do. And some people might find it's kind of boring, but it's a dramatic there's a dramatic possibility for deep, abiding sense of peace and well-being. Built into this, at least in the Buddhist kind of philosophy, is that there's a kind of a deep trust in the innate kind of goodness of a person, and that if you can kind of let fall away all the ways in which we distract ourselves from the present moment, all the ways we get reactive and caught up and concerned, we fill the space, we fill the mind, the heart, with all our concerns, reactions, and everything, that we don't allow very often the chance for the heart or the mind to kind of the deeper wellsprings of it to kind of bubble up. And those deeper wellsprings belong to this innate goodness we have. So it's not necessarily, it's not a boring thing to be really present. It opens up kind of beautiful, beautiful doors in our heart that usually are closed or just not attended to. So we learn to pay attention to what is. So it's a very simple thing in theory. They say it's very, mindfulness they say is very simple. What's hard is remembering to do it. Because, your mind goes off and come back, let's do it here. Over time, the mind gets stronger, the mindfulness gets stronger and becomes easier and easier to stay in the present moment. So we pay attention to what's going on. And whatever you could experience is worthy of our attention. And if you just stay in the present moment, you can have these general categories that includes much of what our experience is. You can, the physical experiences, breath in the body, listening sounds, there can be smells and tastes, they're all kind of physical. And then there's the emotions, the whole feeling side, inside. And then there's the cognitive side of thoughts and ideas and stories we have. That covers a pretty big range of what humans experience. If you open your eyes, then there's also seeing. You can do seeing, you can see. You can have sounds. So we can notice all these things. And maybe I said this last week, but as you notice how these things are, it's kind of like, I don't know if I said this last week, but it's kind of like, if I have my hand and my hand wants the striker, I can have the striker, or I can reach out for the striker. And as I'm reaching out for it, as I have it, I'm concerned about the striker. And then I'm glad I have my striker. But what I might not notice is how I hold the striker, how I reach out for it. I might be holding it really tightly, clenching it. Or I might hold it very loosely, so loosely it falls out of my hand. Or I might hold it very lightly, with open hand. There's many ways of holding it. Sometimes it's not so easy to notice. If you really want something, you're so concerned with wanting it and holding it, you might not notice how you're holding it. So the same thing with awareness. That if we pay attention to something, usually we're paying attention to something. So, you know, if I'm paying attention to my breathing, I'm paying attention to my breath. I'm paying attention to my knee aching, I'm paying attention to the knee. And if we want to be comprehensive and include in awareness everything that's going on, we also want to turn around and look at the nature of how we are paying attention, how we're holding it, the quality of that flash, that light that looks, that shines. And that's a really important key to understanding much about who we are. So to say it in a very different way, there's always two things happening. Only two things. There's what's happening and how we relate to what's happening. So if there's a loud sound outside, that's what's happening. And then there's how I relate to that. I can get angry. How could someone have a car with broken muffler driving down the street? And, you know, and how could these people at IMC have built meditation center, you know, in a noisy street? And there can be all this irritation. So we're paying attention to the sound, but it's being paying attention to it through the filter of that irritation about it. But since we're so concerned about the sound, we don't notice that we're seeing it through some mild irritation. Or there's a knee pain, and so we pay attention to the knee, but we don't notice that the attention has a lot of aversion or a lot of fear connected to it. Or we're told to pay attention, and some people are very dutiful, and they take their attention, they jerk their attention around, and they pounce on their experience. They're going to blast it away, you know. And some people have a lot of resistance. If you tell me to do something, I'll probably do the opposite. You know, I'm a rebel. And so you know, now I'm supposed to pay attention to my breath. Well, great. You know, who's he telling me what to do? And well, you know, okay, well, I'll try, you know, but I don't believe in this stuff. And so there's an attitude that goes into the attention. And if we focus too much on the breath, we might not notice the attitude. Is this making sense? This is a very important one. Someone not understand what I'm trying to say? So there's, or say it a different way, there's what we experience, and there's how we experience it. Not the how of it, but how we are as the experiencer. So your relationship to your experience is a very important part of the whole picture. And in fact, in Buddhism, it's how you relate to your experience which is the key to freedom. Because Buddhism is not about changing the world per se, you know, in meditation, but rather is changing how you relate to the world. So if you're always relating to yourself as a victim or as an aggressor or as someone who's unworthy, then you have a relationship to yourself which is painful. Can you experience yourself without seeing yourself, without relating to yourself through a filter, those kinds of filters? You know, I can sit here and be attending to my breath, and then I can feel that my, you know, that I can't stay more than half a breath at a time. Half a breath doesn't seem very good, so therefore I'm a lousy meditator. This is really, you know, this is probably hopeless for me. And so then, well, I'll try some more, but this is so discouraging. And so there's this relationship I have then with trying to pay attention to the breath, what I'm doing. And the relationship in some ways is counterproductive. It's messy. And so it's important to notice, I'm adding this relationship to it. What would it be like to be aware of something and not relate to it? Not be in relationship to it. Not be for it, not be against it. Not have that mental activity that kind of has a judgment about it or an attitude towards it. And so one of the possibilities as the practice gets stronger is that as the awareness gets stronger and the awareness stands out by itself, and the mind is not relating to what it's being aware of. It's not for it, not against it, not judging it. It's just something there. It's great. Most people need a vacation like that. Because most minds are constantly relating. We're constantly scanning the environment or the future or the past. We want something, we don't want something. We're judging, we're not judging. We're trying to relate ourselves to that, figure out how we fit into all that. And there's all these relationships built into it, all these attitudes built into that. And what is it like to just let a sound arise, be aware of the sound, and not try to judge the sound, not to make anything out of it, to experience a mind wandering away from the breath in meditation, and just let it be, oh, look, that's a mind wandering away. Without any added relationship, oh, poor me, that was a bad breath, you know, whatever. It's just a mind wandering away. So in order to be able to experience that kind of peace that just simply sees things as they are without being in relationship, we have to also be able to notice when we are in relationship, how we are in relating. So what's the quality of that attention? So I've said this in many ways now, and I hope it makes some sense. And so I tried it during that sitting I went through and kind of gave the basic kind of instructions, guided instructions for the different things. And at the end, I had you look at the quality of the flashlight, the light, the awareness. And I'm curious to hear from some of you what you might have noticed when you do that turning around and looking at the quality of the attention.
So I noticed two related but different kinds of thoughts that I was having. One that I labeled sort of student thought, and another was student question. And the student thought was, I would notice something going on in my body, and then I would notice that I was recalling something from a previous lesson. And I'd say, oh, student thought. And I found that those would sort of influence my attention, but were sort of lightly held.
Great.
But then I would notice something that I would have a sort of question about, and I found that it almost felt like sort of right here there was a question that was like trying to burn itself into my, you know, long-term memory. Don't let go of this because you're gonna, you know, go back to your breath and then you're not gonna remember what you wanted to ask or what you wanted to think about afterwards. And when you asked about the quality of the light, at first I thought that the experience I was having associated with these thoughts was one of interest, but then hearing you talk about it, the relationship with that quality, it felt, I think there's more of an attachment to analysis, not so much judging whether I'm doing it right or wrong, but really trying to pick apart, oh, what's happening, and kind of steering things.
Great, so that's a great thing to see. And that kind of taking things apart and analyzing is being in a relationship to it. That's more involved than just simply knowing it for what it is. Just in a very simple way, obviously. In the most obvious way, oh, this is what it is. There's, you know, there's a burning question, just burning question, or whatever, you know. And so it's very important for you to see that difference, because if you could continue the route of trying to get in there and tease things apart and break things apart, and you're not going to be meditating.
Well, I felt like you were a mind reader in that, because everything you said was at the exact time that I was experiencing things. So the interesting thing for me was I was having a thought, and then you were saying, oh, have we wandered off thinking? And then I was realizing that I think you led to how do you feel, something about emotions. And I realized that it was a really sad thought, and I got sad about it. And it was a sadness that it had an experience at the appropriate time before, but now was, because it was like there was room for it to, in
right,
my mind, to come up, mm-hmm, to come through, which was really gratifying. It kind of showed me for the first time how powerful it can be to quiet down and experience something.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that.
Great. Thank you. So there's what's happening and how we relate to what's happening. And a lot of the freedom happens when we start noticing how we relate. Do we relate with an open hand, kind of, or do we relate with a clutched hand? Do we relate with an open hand, or do we relate with kind of a hand that's trying to push things away? What is that relationship? And if you're always trying to fix the world, your experience, to make your experience a better experience, always manipulating it, then you haven't really turned around and looked at what that relationship is, and then begin to settle that relationship. You don't have to always be in relationship. It's actually a very radical thing for the mind to do, to stop relating, stop being for and against the stuff. So in mindfulness practice, from time to time, if you're paying attention to something, like you're paying attention to a knee pain or a sound or an emotion, whatever it might be, it can be very useful to ask yourself, how am I relating to this? What's my attitude towards this? Is my attitude open and kind of a light curiosity or just open interest or open awareness? Or is there aversion? Is there desire? Is there a lot of doubt? Is there a lot of trying to figure out? Is there a lot of analysis? You know, what is the relationship to what's going on? And once you start seeing that relationship that you have, the attitude you have, that helps make things simpler. If you can simplify kind of easily the attitude, make it simpler, more open, then please do it. If it's not simple to let go of it, don't make a lot of effort to let go of it. What's your relationship to being in relationship? So, you know, I'm not supposed to be aversive towards my experience. It's okay to be aversive. What we're trying to do here is notice what is. And one of the things to notice is the relationship you have. And if you notice, for example, that you're aversive, that you're angry, the more clearly you can know that you're being angry or aversive, the less you're living in the anger or the aversion. It's like you step back and see it for what it is. And then it's not going to be so influential. It's not going to be pushing you around, or it's not going to be the filter through which you see your experience. So it's a very useful thing to notice what that underlying attitude is towards our experience, because it has a big bearing on how we see our life, how we see ourselves, how we react to our life, how we react to ourselves. And as more and more we become aware of that, the freer you can become. The more wise you can be about the choices you make about how you go about your life. So from time to time in this practice, we ask ourselves, what's my relationship to what's happening right now? And then we see what's there. There's no need to analyze it, no need to get into it in a big psychoanalysis of it all, and why it should be there and all that. It's very simple. And if it's not a simple answer, then just put it to rest and ask the question, you know, sometime later again. It becomes kind of automatic after a while. You kind of notice. It's just part of the territory that you notice as you do the practice. One of the reasons this is important is that there can be simple relationships. There's a sound that happens outside for a moment, and then we have a momentary reaction to it. There can be an itch, and we have a reaction to the itch, maybe for the duration of the itch. So some attitudes, some relationships are momentary, don't last very long. But some last for a long time. Some become the background mood, background attitude, which we walk through our days with. Sometimes they're much more, maybe more subtle. But sometimes there's a whole, like some people, there are some people for whom fear is a pervasive background attitude that's always there for them. They're always apprehensive and worried about something or other. And that's always kind of the background attitude or way they're relating to something. Even if they're happy or delighted or aversive or angry, it's not so far away. Kind of the background kind of quality of the mind is one of fear. Some people can be angry. There are times when there might be a background mood or attitude, or something might be one of love or kindness. There's a variety of different things. So the jewel that we talk about in Buddhism, the jewel of the heart and the mind, is the deeper pervasive attitude that we have that kind of is kind of shaping or influencing how we think, how we feel, how we go about our life. And so as the mind gets quieter and still, as we learn to be more present here and now, we start noticing this deeper aspect of ourselves, the deeper attitudes, deeper underlying kind of conditioning that influences it all. And sometimes it can be quite a big surprise to discover some of that. And as we become aware of it, then again, that which is... there's this beautiful thing that happens with attention, with mindfulness. And that is that... and the analogy I like to use is that of a greenhouse. If the greenhouse is covered over with curtains, and it's hot and humid and dark, all the slime and mold and yucky stuff grows. But if you pull the curtains out and you let the sunshine shine into the greenhouse, the slime and the mold dries out, but the flowers in there have a chance to grow and bloom and become beautiful. Awareness is like sunlight. And if there's no awareness that shines in our inner greenhouse, that's the condition for slime growing. Or how Buddhists say it is that the conditions, the forces of the mind that bring suffering, the unhealthy attitudes of the mind, the big-time kind of afflictive reactions that the mind can have, they thrive with a lack of awareness. So anger, greed, delusion, fear do really well, can thrive the best, the less you're aware of them. The more you're aware of them, it's like having sunlight on the mold, on the slime or whatever, and it dries out. And the more awareness there is on qualities like generosity and love and kindness and truthfulness and patience, equanimity, peacefulness and calm, there's a way in which those things grow in the light of awareness. You don't have to do anything about it. You just have to be aware. And so as you begin noticing your relationship, your attitude to experience, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to judge yourself. Remember what I said earlier, 2 weeks ago, meditation is the best place in the world to have murderous rage. Because this is the place you're allowed. It's okay. This is like the one place in maybe the world where it's really okay to have murderous rage. You know, lucky you. It's because you're not going to judge it, you're not going to be for it, not against it. Just there, you make space for it. And it's safe because you're not going to punch anybody out when you're sitting still. You're committed to sitting still. But then what we do is, what the commitment is to paying attention to it, to noticing what's there. And so we notice what's there, and just the noticing itself, as we get stronger and stronger, it has a powerful effect on the inner life. It dries out the stuff that should be dried out, and it nourishes the stuff that can be nourished. And as things get nourished, then the heart, or this mind, or this underlying deeper attitude becomes purified or clear, becomes quite beautiful. And it becomes one of the most precious things we have. And so then one of the tremendous teachers that we have in Buddhism is the teacher of your own heart or your own mind. As we begin seeing this purified or this freed awareness or attitude that is not tied up with relating and wanting and not wanting, and we feel how beautiful or how satisfying it is to have this kind of lightness, this ease, this well-being. And as we feel the mind or the heart having this well-being, it becomes a teacher for you. Because then, because you're being mindful, you notice when you lose it. You notice what the forces in the mind are that cause you to lose your well-being and your ease or your freedom. And you study that. You bring your attention to that. And there are times when you can see that difference and you can choose one over the other. You can say, well, look at that. I don't have to, you know, continue on this rant in my mind. I don't have to keep judging myself or I don't have to keep being angry. There's another approach here. I can let go of that. Or I can be mindful enough so I don't give into it. And so in Buddhism, the idea in Buddhism at least is you're supposed to become your own teacher. And the vehicle for becoming your own teacher is your awareness, is this mindfulness practice. When you start seeing how all this operates in a deeper way within us. So we say there's a jewel in us that we always carry with us, but it's often covered over by some grimy old coat. And the thing is to kind of take off that coat and realize that there's something really precious here that we can use as a reference point, as a guide for how we live our lives. So did that make enough sense? So maybe you want, those of you who didn't make sense, or anybody, why don't you ask some questions about it, or what I've said so far?
While you were speaking, I was meditating, you know, with everybody else. I didn't understand a word that you said. Everything came across as just a tonal variation. Period. No words whatsoever.
Is that pleasant?
And the only time that I turned, when I looked at myself, I caught myself saying, Jesus, I don't understand a word he's saying. And then I went back on this plane. Everything was on the same plane.
Was it pleasant?
Oh, it was great. But I didn't understand, you know, everything was a tone.
Maybe you didn't need to. And understand. So I don't know what was going on for you. I mean, it could be that you were sleepy. You know, end of the day.
Could be.
But it could also be that you had dropped into a deeper state of meditation. And in deeper states of meditation, the normal thinking mind and perceiving mind doesn't operate so strongly. And it's not interesting. You know, something external, someone talking, is just not interesting. It's much more interesting is this deeper state of calm or well-being. And so either you can tune it out the mind has to be somewhat active to take in and understand speech. And if the mind gets calm enough, that activity of taking in speech is not going to be operating so strongly. And go for it. That's fine. I'm happy. You know, tune me out. It's interesting. This is an interesting phenomenon that some of you should know about. That, you know, the human mind... A big part of what the human mind does is it makes representations in itself. It models representations in the mind of reality that we have around us. And so the mind constructs images or models for this world we have, including that for ourselves. And we often think that we're experiencing things directly, but we often experience things through the filter of this relatively complex mental processing that goes on. So just simply to be aware that you have a body and the body has this shape, whatever shape it is, and your hand is in, you know, one location, your foot is in another location, is all being processed through an activity of the mind. It's pretty innocent, but it's still an activity, doing of the mind. As the mind gets, sometimes when the mind gets calmer and calmer in meditation, it takes in the stimulus, all the sense stimulus that comes in from the environment, and it still tries to reconstruct it into a model. But it doesn't do quite a good job anymore because it's kind of relaxed. And so people have sometimes these strange sensory kind of odd perceptions sometimes when they meditate. Sometimes they feel suddenly like their body gets really long and tall, like I'm going to hit the ceiling, or really squat, you know. And it just feels kind of bizarre. I'm suddenly so squat. I'm just, you know, squeezed to the floor. I mean, my neck is really long. And there's usually a short phase that people go through. And then with time, the mind gets quieter and that kind of activity settles away. And then there's some point there's no very little experience of the body at all, because it's just not needed anymore because the mind is so calm. It's not necessarily the purpose of meditation to have these experiences, but they can happen. And just go along for the ride.
So my flashlight was really dim, and it wasn't very powerful at all. And as I was moving it around, I felt really overwhelmed, and as if I wanted to walk away. It was that overwhelming and scary, and I thought, well, this is maybe I just didn't feel ready for it tonight.
Uh-huh.
But it was. Overwhelming. I don't know if you
could
comment on that.
So one thing is, once you could see that clearly, like you did now, how would that information serve you as you continue meditating? How is that information useful?
Well, I know I have a flashlight now, which is good. I guess I know what to expect next time. It was strange as I was. It seemed like it was a room that was inside of my chest, and I was inside of the room, and I was looking around, and it was all dark. And as I shined my flashlight around, the room was completely empty except for a big box in the middle of the room, and the box was dark, and you couldn't see into the box. I thought, oh no. that's what's waiting for me, is whatever is in that box. And that was really intimidating.
Maybe, and the box will open when it's ready.
Yeah.
But one of the things you can do is to turn the attention to your fear. And so rather than being influenced by the fear, or making the fear kind of kind of directing the show, which is very easy to do, you turn around and look at the fear directly. And so what do you think would happen if you just actually befriended your fear by seeing it? There you are, I see you, fear. What do you think would happen for you? You might try it. So another analogy I like for this practice. Imagine that there's actors and actresses on a stage. And there's a stage director, and in the chairs, in the watching. The stage director's job is to direct the actors and tell the actors what to do. But the stage director doesn't have to notice himself or herself; has to just tell what to do out there. We often have a stage director who's directing the show, judging the show, commenting about the show. And the stage director is not on stage, so we don't have to notice the stage director. We just have to know what's on the stage. But in mindfulness practice, the idea is to have no stage director. Everything goes on the stage, including the stage director. So that what I mean here is there's nothing that we leave off stage. Everything is put on stage so we notice what it is. So if you had a strong reaction to that experience, like you're afraid of it, it's very easy to leave that off stage, because that's about the practice. That's about, the practice was noticing and having a flashlight and all that stuff, and your reaction to doing that practice was fear. That's not the practice. It's a reaction to the practice, so therefore let's leave it off stage. But in this practice, there's no off stage. Does that make some sense?
Yes.
And I'll take it one step further. For you, might be interesting, is when something is off stage, then awareness excludes something. There's something which, and many times people have things which are acceptable for awareness that we can pay attention to, and things which are unacceptable. And people sometimes have very dramatic blinders on, and sometimes it's just they had never got around to noticing something else, but awareness is partial. The most sacred reality in Buddhism is when awareness is all-inclusive, when there's nothing outside, nothing that's being held out. There's no blinders on. Everything's allowed to come in. You include everything. And it turns out to be the safest place to be, even if the box is still closed. To just be aware of a closed box. Aware of the fear of having the closed box. And see how it goes from there. Does that make some sense? So someone else.
Last week I talked a little bit about being more comfortable in my thoughts than my feelings. And then this week, when I was meditating, I noticed that it depended on how deep I was going into the feelings. And if I got to an uncomfortable place, I'd bubble up into my thoughts. And so tonight, you're playing with some of the ideas. And it's like, well, what is the quality of that? Well, it's control of thought over feelings. And so I wanted to thank you for that, because the quality of, to be aware of the quality of wanting to control things is a pretty nice thing to be seeing.
Why?
Huh?
Why is it nice to see it?
I can open my hand up a little bit more.
Good. You don't have to be so controlling.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, and then the other one was when you were talking about the quality, deep in the meditation, the quality of the seer and how I felt about it. There was two sides at the same time that was kind of interesting. There was security and there was fear all at the same time. And I was like, huh.
It's very interesting. Let's see where it goes from there.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to it.
Thank you. I wanted to do one more meditation tonight. So again, taking a upright, alert posture. And in this alert posture, kind of settle yourself in to be relaxed. Softly close the eyes. And then notice very simply any obvious ways in which you're relating to the idea of meditating right now. What's your attitude towards doing the second meditation? And that attitude that you have, is it one that is supportive of the meditation practice or one that interferes? And if you notice an attitude, just clearly acknowledge it. No need to be different. And then take a couple of deep breaths to really start the sitting and settle in further. And then feel your breathing. And we'll stay quiet together for about 5 minutes. Will you just kind of meditate with your breathing? Meditate in the way that I've taught you so far, as best you can. But mostly just stay with your breathing if you can. And after about 5 minutes, I'll give a little different instruction. So then as we go on here, I'm going to offer you a very different image for the practice. So as you're sitting here with your eyes closed, listen and take in this image, and then I'll give the instructions. And the image is of a one-room house, small little house, that has a door and windows. And in the middle of this one-room house is an easy chair. And you sit in this easy chair, very comfortable, relaxed. The door is open, the windows are open. And as you stay in the easy chair, from time to time, something appears at the door and the window. A bird flies by, a squirrel stands in front of the front door, then runs off. And as things occur, the door or the windows, you don't leave your easy chair. You don't go looking for it or go out to get it. You stay easy and relaxed and let things appear. And in Buddhism, this one-room house with the door and the windows is an analogy for the human body. The different sense doors, windows to our senses, to hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, being aware of the mind, seeing. So imagine you're here sitting, practicing, and you're relaxed in an easy chair. And you don't have to go and direct your awareness anywhere. What you notice is what appears at one of the doors or windows. You don't go looking for sounds, a sound appears. You don't go looking for thought or feeling or the breath. You just allow something to arise and appear, and you know what it is. And in this way, awareness is more, less like a flashlight and more like a bulb which radiates out freely in all directions. Allowing your experience to arise and pass as it does, without controlling it or directing it, but staying present for what's occurring. And then to end this sitting, notice for a moment what attitude there might be for you that's operating, that maybe you haven't noticed yet. And acknowledge it very simply, directly, without being for or against it. And then take a couple of deep breaths, and when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So awareness is a quite variable how it's experienced or used. Sometimes it can be used like a flashlight. Sometimes it's used as just an open field, like a bulb which is just radiating out, or just like a room with just windows all around. That whatever arises can arise. Whatever happens can happen. One is more called mindfulness with choice. We choose where attention goes. The other is called choiceless awareness. We just don't make any choice. We don't choose or control where the attention goes. We allow experiences to arise choicelessly, and we notice what it is as it occurs. The choiceless side the mind has to be quite stable for this to work. And so usually people use the mindfulness with choice. You choose to pay attention to the breath until the mind gets concentrated. Because if the mind is scattered and thinking a lot, you really need to have some kind of grounding. But when the mind gets concentrated, sometimes we let go of it, directing the mind to pay attention to anything. We still notice, but the mind is not directed. We just let things come to you. You notice what goes on. So there's different ways of doing this practice, and I say that not because you're supposed to master this overnight, because I tell you this, but rather to kind of give you a sense of what some of the possibilities are and that it's not just a one way of doing one kind of practice. You get one kind of instruction. Now you think you know what it is, but it's actually a whole kind of playground of attention, of awareness of the mind that we explore and develop, and it's quite fascinating as we go along. So that what I talked about today is considered to be quite profound in Buddhism. So if you didn't quite understand what I was trying to say, don't worry about it. But maybe I was hoping to give you some indication of how profound or how significant this practice can be if you kind of stay with it for a while. At least the minimum that I hope that you learned from today is that there's always two things happening. There's what's happening and how you relate to it. And as you do meditation practice from time to time, you can just check in with yourself. How am I relating to what's going on now? What's the relationship here? And because if you can notice that relationship, sometimes that can make things a lot easier, can clear things up. And the rest of what I said, if it doesn't make sense, maybe it will some other time. And then I also mentioned this in the beginning of the day today, beginning of the class, is that there's a lot of material that you were given, this instructions in the course of this, so far this 5 weeks. Don't feel like you have to master it all. You might feel just be content you've taken in whatever you can. And you might want to go back and spend a few weeks with the instructions for the first week or the second week. And you have these handouts that hopefully you took home with you and review some of the instructions. And just kind of stay simple with the breath for a few weeks before you open it up to, the body or the feelings. You don't have to open it up so quickly. Some of you might find opening it up quickly to wider range is very useful. So that is the kind of the most, what I've given so far is the most basic kind of instructions for what we do here, the mindfulness practice. We have one more class next week. And next week I'm going to teach a little bit about how it won't be as profound as today, meaning it won't be so confusing if some of you are confused. And But rather, we'll take it, I'll talk about how we can take this practice to a different level, or how to develop it or strengthen it in a variety of different ways that are not so esoteric. You know, it's kind of very simple, as a matter of fact. And in particular, how to take this, the meditation practice of mindfulness, and how to translate it or apply it into our daily life. And that's really one of the very important things to do, is not just simply meditate. And meditation is, you know, it's nice. But in order to live a... In Buddhism, we use the language of freedom a lot. In order to live a free life, it really, what's important is your freedom in daily life, not just sitting there and meditating free. And so how do we bring mindfulness to our daily life and our daily activities? And that becomes a very rich area. So it's one of the things we'll talk about next week. So thank you. And I hope you have a wonderful week, relating or not.